deep breath, had it under my tunic, walked into the room, and bedlam.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we have the replica Jules Rimet FIFA World Cup trophy.
This is Stealing Victory, the untold story of the 1966 World Cup heist. Episode 6, The Old Switcheroo. Just hours after the Jules Rimet trophy was stolen, the FA had secretly commissioned the making of a replica. And a week later, the real thing turned up in Dave Corbett's South London front garden. But what happened to them after that? I'm Tom Pettifor, crime editor at the Daily Mirror. I tracked down some of the people at the centre of the story to find out.
Just to get out, go down to the communal wash area, and you'd be looking right across the main road, and there was always tarts in the playground giving it some young coppers. Of course, that was all, way, but it was a good time.
In the summer of 1966, Peter Weston was a rookie PC, or in his own words, a sprog. He was just 4 months into his training at Paddington Green Police Station, where he stayed in the single men's digs. After the lads jeered at the scantily clad women across the way, the mornings would start with a roll call.
They had a basement at Paddington there, where it was an overflow cells, and that's where we used to do the parading of a morning. You used to have to stand there with your truncheon in your hand and your whistle in your pocketbook and pen and all that.
July the 30th, 1966, the day England would play West Germany in the World Cup final at Wembley. When he appeared for the morning parade, Peter was sent up to see his superintendent. He thought he was in trouble, but it turned out he was being assigned a secret mission. Along with two experienced PCs, he was tasked with visiting the head of the FA at their West London headquarters to get his orders.
So at this point, what did you think you were doing?
No idea. We didn't have a clue. And not until we actually arrived and then were introduced to the secretary, who then explained, right, you know, today is cup final day, and he had two wooden boxes on his desk, and then he went on to explain, this is the World Cup, and this is the replica, and this is what you're going to do.
So you go into a room at the FA, and the World Cup trophy, the Jules Rimet trophy, is there, but then there's another trophy?
Yeah, which is, he explained, this is the Jules Rimet, this is the duplicate.
Right.
Obviously, we were just wide-eyed, really. You will be taking these to the stadium where you'll be met by the head of security. You will give him the Jules Rimet trophy and keep the replica. And after the game, if England win, we want you to swap the trophies when you get the chance.
And then what did you do next?
Saluted. I sort of walked out the door in the daze, I suppose, with these two boxes.
While Peter contemplated his mission, another Londoner, George Cohen, was starting the biggest day of his life. George played right back for Fulham and England. The night before, he had been told by England manager Alf Ramsey that he was picked to start in the World Cup final, and he'd be vice-captain. George was sharing a room with England's combative midfielder, Nobby Stiles, who sadly passed away a couple of weeks after this interview.
I always remember him getting up early, so early. I said, well, Nobby, where are you going? He said, I'm going to find the Catholic Church to pray and confess. So I said, pray? Where? So he said, Golders Green. I don't know if that means anything.
Golders Green, yeah. Golders good, Green. Good place for synagogue.
I looked at him and I said, don't say anything, George. Don't say anything. Anyway, he's gone out and he's found one, you know. But he was lovely.
Right, Nobby. So he's a real character.
Tremendous.
Right.
I cannot tell you how good he was for that squad. What a player. You know, he didn't look anything, but by Christ, you didn't want to play against him.
No, I wouldn't, by the looks
Is
of
that
it.
Too you'd, much
be,
in your eyes, yeah?
You'd be lucky if you walked off the pitch.
Well, I don't know if you saw that game against Portugal. He was marking Eusebio. Eusebio was about 6 inches taller, 6 yards faster, you know, and a terrific player. But he played him all over the place. He played him out of danger zone all the time, never let him turn. In the end, if you recall, he went off in tears towards the end of the match. But only because Nobby Stiles ruled the midfield. And people were scared of him too. You know, he's only a little fella, but by Christ, he was a butcher at times.
Once Nobby got back, having found a Catholic church in an area known for its Jewish community, the team met up for breakfast.
I got down to breakfast. Everybody was there. There was an atmosphere. It's very difficult to explain. but you could feel that there was the excitement there in the players, you know, and Alf was looking a bit drawn, I thought.
Alf Ramsey, England's no-nonsense manager, had vowed before the tournament that his team would win it.
He had got us that far, you know, far better than any other manager has ever done. You know, he just wanted to say, look, have your breakfast, keep it all calm, and then we're going to get in the coach and we're going to go to Wembley. And I'm going to give you plenty of time to do that. Well, it's just as well it did, because there were thousands of people there. They were choking the roads and things like that. And people that saw us go past getting near Wembley were, you know, saying, England, England, all that business, you know. They got the big doors where you drive through, yeah, at Wembley. And we couldn't get to them. We had to clear the way, and people were, you know, could feel that the crowd wanted us to win. You know, you could feel it. It was a most wonderful atmosphere as far as I'm concerned, you know.
Peter and George were both on their way to Wembley. One had his heart set on winning the cup, the other was fretting about how to swap it. Peter loved the game and was a keen amateur player. So despite the heavy burden of responsibility on his shoulders, he'll never forget watching the game from the players' tunnel, just feet from his heroes.
As a 21-year-old, you're standing in the tunnel in complete awe. It's where there was a fantastic atmosphere. It's difficult to explain. Everybody was just overwhelmed with it, really. And when you think there's 100,000 people all in the same euphoric from Germany and England, it just gobbles you up, doesn't it? It just sweeps over you.
So were you in the tunnel then before the match? Could you see the players?
In fact, on the newsreel, you can see me in the tunnel. I can see myself, it's me! But, you know, to one side. And then, yeah, they walk past me now onto the pitch. And it's not until later, I suppose, you then think, oh, dear. And then you suddenly realise what you've actually done.
England didn't get off to a good start, going a goal down in the 12th minute. George was fighting to keep his nerve.
When the Germans scored the first goal, it was quite numbing. It was... and I've never experienced the situation before. It was a strange atmosphere.
England clawed their way back into the game. At full time, it was 2-2, so it went to extra time. 11 minutes in, England striker Jeff Hurst smashed a shot off the underside of West Germany's crossbar. The referee wasn't sure if it had gone over the line, and in one of the most hotly contested decisions in World Cup history, the linesman said it had. England were 3-2 up. In the dying seconds of the match, the Germans threw men forward in an effort to equalise. George recalls what happened next.
Bobby Moore actually received the ball. He's controlled it, taken it out to the wing a bit, so away from the goal. He hasn't panicked at all. You know, he's looked up and he's seen Jeff peel off his centre-back, and he's hit the most tremendous driven chip right in Jeff's stride. It was a terrific ball, and Jeff will tell you that he got the ball at his feet. Bally, Hursty, fuck you, I'm going to want that trick. And he said, I'm going to whack this, he said, because if it doesn't go in the goal, it goes over the bar. And we could see the referee was looking at his watch order every second or so. And he's hit, it's gone straight in the net. So he gets a hat trick and a knighthood.
George was a member of the only England team ever to win the World Cup. But despite his euphoria, he had run himself into the ground. He still vividly recalls the agony of climbing the 39 steps to the Royal Box.
After a game like that as well, you know, extra time, they were pretty knackering, you know. I think we saw Bobby Moore do that famous thing where he wiped his hands down his trunk so that he didn't get some grubby hands on the Queen's gloves or something. But the people going up the steps were, you know, wanted to pat you on the shoulder and one thing another, and wanted to grab hold of it. Going down was the same.
Footage of the day shows the team doing a lap of honour with the trophy. Stony-faced plainclothes security guards are in close attendance. But for George and his teammates, it was a time for pure celebration.
Do you remember getting given the trophy at any point?
Yes, I got the trophy for a little while and it passed on, you know. And running around everything, yeah. We didn't particularly want it running. It was quite difficult to run and hold this bloody thing up, you know. But the fact is, the crowd were ecstatic, absolutely ecstatic.
At the end of their lap of honour, Captain Bobby Moore tossed the cup into the air and caught it. He then led the players back into the changing room.
Getting back into the dressing room, you sat there for a while, then it really, really dawned on you, Jesus Christ, we've won the World Cup. Can you believe all that? It was terrific. I mean, obviously, all excited, and Nobby was doing a dance. They were so pleased, they were chatting, they were talking to each other. You can see the, you know, the exuberance of it all. And Elf was standing there, just sort of a smile on his face.
Peter remained in the tunnel, waiting for the right moment. How do you prize a trophy away from a group of players who have dedicated their whole lives to winning it, and without anyone seeing?
The old timers weren't going to do it, so the Sprog was going to do it. I suppose they'd had a little chat, but I ain't going to do it. Well, he can do it, he's the patsy. And the patsy standing there thinking, well, why me? My thoughts back are, how the hell am I going to do that? I don't know. So it's a case of just pick your time. And you say, well, okay, deep breath, in you go. Had it under my tunic, walked into the dressing room, and bedlam. It was packed with people. My mind thinking was, I hope Jackie Charlton's not holding it. And I had no idea what I was going to do, because Jackie would have told me to go away.
Centre-back Jackie Charlton was a big man and a formidable character. He led by example, putting his body on the line for the team. Jackie was a miner's son from Northumberland. He wouldn't be giving up the cup for anyone, not even a policeman. The Leeds United legend died in July 2020 while we were making this podcast. Thousands of mourners lined the streets of his hometown of Ashington to pay their final respects, testament to how much he was loved. Fortunately for Peter, Jackie didn't have the cup when he went into the changing room.
Just out of sheer luck, Nobby was sitting starry-eyed, almost in tears, with it in his lap.
Nobby, you'll remember, was the England midfielder who had shared a room with George and gone for confession that morning.
Nobby was on his own, and I just walked up and said, Nobby, you have this and I'll have that. And he looked at me and went, OK. And I took the real one off him and I went straight out and then put it in the boot of the car.
And that was it. 54 years later, when I saw George in the summer of 2020, he still had no idea what had happened.
No, I didn't see it.
No. He was told, get that cup and exchange it for the replica. He said Nobby Stiles looked so dazed, yeah. And because he was wearing a policeman's uniform, in those days everyone respected the officer.
He thought he was under arrest, yeah.
So he exchanged it with Nobby Stiles, and Nobby Stiles never mentioned it to anyone, and no one ever knew
about it. This is the first I've heard of it.
Right.
Really, after all these years, you'd have thought that I'd have known something like that.
At around the same time in the changing room, Captain Bobby Moore was called out to speak to an official.
And he came back and he said, guys, he said, the FA have just said that they're going to give us £22,000. I'm rich. I'm rich. At last, I can buy a row of houses with that. And he said, between us. I knew there was a deafening silence. And then the language came out, of course.
Did it? So it
was
a
very lot of jelly on it, I tell you.
So then 22 grand divided by the whole squad, though. So everyone,
1,000 each.
Yeah. So whether you played in the final or not, everyone got 1,000. But how did the players feel about the fact that the dog, effectively, or the owner of the dog, got £6,000 and the players got £1,000 for winning the World Cup?
It's my wife here. No. I cannot tell you. I cannot tell you the language. Perhaps we should go and see for another 5,000 quid.
I think you deserve
no,
at
but
least
I think well, I think the Germans got more money than we did. You know, right. Obviously we couldn't get any less, could you? Let's face it. But it was mean.
And there was more meanness to come from the men in suits at the FA. You're listening to Stealing Victory. I'll be back after a short break. This is Stealing Victory. The celebrations moved from Wembley to the Royal Garden Hotel on Kensington High Street, where a dinner was being put on. But the players didn't get the reception they expected or deserved.
When we got into the dining room, our wives weren't there.
So this is on the day that you've won the World Cup for England. Yes. The first time England's ever won the World Cup. You guys had done it for us, yeah. And the FA wouldn't let you bring your wives into the dinner.
They wouldn't let us. We didn't have any choice. We didn't even know until we got there. We all expect our wives to be there in the dining room or meet us in the lounge outside that. And they weren't there. And then we discovered that they were upstairs somewhere in a burger bar or something. You know, it was a bit... it was outrageous. We just couldn't believe it. You know, all the other officials' wives were there, and ours weren't. That's rankled with me and our players for years and years and years. It was a sort of a them and us occasion. You've got to remember, we still were the peak cap era. in 1966. It was a case of, well, look, why have they segregated? Why haven't our wives been with us? Why aren't they with us?
In 1966, football was a sport played and watched by working men in cloth caps. The FA officials were from the elite. The segregation at the winners' dinner reflected the class divide within the country, and it was also reflected in the huge disrespect shown to the architect of England's greatest ever victory, the manager, Alf Ramsey.
Another thing, that Alf Ramsey didn't get his. I took his down to Ipswich.
His winner's medal.
Yeah.
So he didn't even pick it up on the day?
No.
He left it all to you guys?
No, but he wasn't around then, was he? He took it down to his wife. He had died by that time.
So he never took it while he was alive?
No. Well, it's absurd, isn't it?
It's really horrible.
It's really absurd.
But I
put it down at the old cloth cap era of English life. The cloth cap era is of them and us, those people that had it, something, and the people that had nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm talking about my experiences when I was a kid in Fulham. I mean, Fulham wasn't bloody affluent in those days, not as it is these days, where there are £1 million houses all over the place. This was when people didn't have anything, you know, and they were scrimping and scraping. Before the war, there were people that didn't have anything to eat still. You know, if you'd gone down the East End, you know, Petticoat Laneway or something like that, people were picking things off the floor. You know, after the market had gone. I saw this in North End Road in Fulham, where people were going after the barrows. I've seen old ladies, in particular, picking sort of carrot up out of the crop and an apple or something like that years ago. And I thought that was absolutely dreadful. It passed, of course. It had to pass. But I saw it, and it stuck with me ever since.
Before his death in 2019... England World Cup winning goalkeeper Gordon Banks said he was disappointed at how the players were treated by the FA. Banks said some were forced to sell their winners' medals because they'd not been properly looked after. Kevin Maguire is the associate editor at my paper, The Daily Mirror, and a leading commentator on British politics.
The class divide, distinctions, gap was really strong still in the 60s. Government was trying to break it down. It was changing to some extent. But if you look at football, there was no doubt. It was kind of masters and men. It was almost the mill owners and the mill hands. And the players who actually win it, they're not really looked after. It's the blazers and the suits who run the game. The owners who get all the plaudits and think they deserve the success. One way you can look at it, the money, but it was, why were so few honours given out to the World Cup winning players? And there's still campaigns now for them all to be awarded knighthoods, either living or posthumously. Mm. But they weren't. I mean, Alf Ramsey, of course, was knighted, and Bobby Charlton down the line, Jeff Hurst did, but most of the other players were just ignored. Now, Britain was still then a country where you're supposed to know your place and keep in your place. And those players, of course, achieved something remarkable. It's not been matched since in any part of the United Kingdom. And yet at that time, they probably didn't get the rewards and the praise that they should have.
And the FA's appalling treatment of the players didn't stop there. After the dinner, they went out onto the balcony of the Royal Garden Hotel to celebrate with the fans.
The crowds around the hotel was enormous. All the people were down the bottom underneath the balcony. Loads of people were there.
And did you have the cup then?
We had the cup then.
Yeah.
But I'm just surprised that there was a substitute hanging around somewhere. Mm. I mean...
Well, that was the substitute that you had that time.
No, that's good. Would have been a bit of a letdown.
No, it was the fake one. You had the fake one on the Garden Hotel. That was
We had the fake one?
Yeah.
I'm staggered. I did not know that. Bloody cheek. Wasn't it outrageous?
Yeah. So you thought you were showing the nation the real cup, but in fact, the FA had secretly swapped it round and given you a fake one.
Just like the FA, isn't it? That's a bloody hell. I don't understand that. I honestly did not know anything about that.
But there was one powerful individual who did give the team the respect they deserved. Prime Minister Harold Wilson spoke to the players after the match.
He said that the World Cup could save the pound because we were actually in a bit of a mess even in 96 again.
Confidence in the pound was plummeting because of an £800 million trade deficit. Wilson was facing calls to devalue sterling, but he resisted, feeling the pound was a symbol of Britain's role as a key player on the world stage. England's victory had helped him stave off devaluation until the following year.
And he said, because of the euphoria and because of the excitement of the country at the time, foreigners might thought that this would lift us out of our lethargy, if you could, whatever you like to call it. And I think he was absolutely right. It did save the pound, just as well.
So you saved the pound.
Yeah.
You didn't get much monetary compensation for that.
Well, we did, in as much as it wasn't taxed.
Very generous.
Well, it was outrageous, really, isn't it?
Shocking. Shocking.
I think it did do the country good. I think it did. There was a sparkle in there from all around the country. It was wonderful.
The policeman who swapped the cups, Peter Weston, eventually left the Met to work as a private investigator. It was during this time that he befriended one of Wilson's former security guards. We heard previously how he said that Wilson and the government were furious and lent on the FA and police to have a replica made. So what's his take on the FA's actions and the swapping of the cups on final day?
It's politics, isn't it? What do you say? You know, who am I? Politics, politics, no, no. It was just pure politics.
So this is not about football, this is about something bigger than football then?
Of course it is, yeah, very much so.
That therefore takes precedence over everything, so it's all about making sure that the country's image is not tainted.
That's a bit of an unfair question, really, Tom.
Okay.
Let's be fair. Are you looking to get into politics now? You know, let's be fair. Have things really changed today?
I don't know. What do you think?
What do you mean you don't know? You know what the situation is. Politics overall rules the roost.
Mm-hmm.
We as individuals either do as we're told or you have a problem. We had a problem, hugely embarrassing problem. Country was being ridiculed and they needed to repair the damage. Regardless, yeah, politics, very much so. And with the intentions of in the national interest, I suppose. The national interest being the group reputation, that we can have these type of competitions and not have a problem.
But if the players were parading the fake, what happened to the real trophy?
Would have put it upstairs in the superintendent's safe, I suppose.
Right, OK.
Unless he took it home, you know.
Took it home and put it on his mantelpiece.
The next competition was hosted by Mexico, and the FA and the British authorities must have heaved a huge sigh of relief when they finally got to hand the real cup over. So what happened to the replica? It was quietly handed back to George Bird, the silversmith who the FA had secretly commissioned to make it. After George's death, the family decided to sell it, and in 1997 it went to auction at Sotheby's.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we have something for the sports aficionados among you. This really is a unique artifact, steeped in history and intrigue. Here we have the replica Jules Rimet FIFA World Cup trophy, created in secret after the theft here in London of the real trophy back in 1966. It's an exquisite gold-plated copy of the original Art Deco depiction of the Greek goddess Nike. And I'll open the bidding at £10,000, £11,000, £12,000. £13,000. We have £13,000 already, looking for £14,000.
The family were expecting perhaps £20,000, not more than £30,000. Not bad for a fake, but there were two bidders in the room who kept going.
Back to you, madam, at £32,000.
And going.
We are now heading towards £140,000.
And going.
We have £254,500. Sir, 255? No. You're out. Your last chance. And selling. Fair warning at £254,500. Going once. Going twice. Sold at £254,500.
More than a quarter of £1 million. It was five times the value placed on the original in 1966. So who were the mystery buyers, and why had they paid so much? It emerged that FIFA and a Brazilian insurance firm got into a bidding war. FIFA won because boss Sepp Blatter had sent his man with orders to get the trophy at any cost. They were desperate to get the cup in case it turned out to be the real one after all. An inspection of the trophy after the auction would confirm that Peter Weston had done his job properly. FIFA had forked out a ridiculous amount of money for a replica they never wanted made in the first place. It's now on display at the Football Museum in Manchester. By now, I'd researched all I could about the fate of the World Cup itself. But what about my search for the man who supposedly stole it, Sidney Cue? It was now 10 months since I'd got the tip-off. If I was going to progress things, I'd have to spread the name more widely, potentially tipping off rival reporters. I decided to ask someone who moved in the right circles if they would put a message on their private Facebook page. Had anyone heard of Sidney Cue or his brother Freddie from the Woolworth Road area? I didn't say why I wanted to know, and they didn't ask. Days went by without any reply. And then on a Tuesday evening in May 2018, I was sitting at my kitchen table when...
Hi, had a comment on one of the groups from someone. She said the full name is Cugalier, and they are both dead.
So I tried Cugalier and Cugalier, but the names drew blanks in my searches. But after a bit of playing with the spelling, I found a Frederick Cugalier who had lived in the Woolworth Road area. My source had told me that Sydney's brother Freddie was a prodigious fence known around London. When I googled the revised spelling of Sidney Cugalier, a reference to a 1961 Court of Appeal ruling popped up.
The defendant had been driving a motor van when he was stopped by the police. In the back of the van, there were found three pickaxe handles bound with adhesive tape. His defence was that he did not know that the implements were in the back of his van.
It was the right era, and the offence of going equipped for theft was exactly the kind of crime I would have expected Sidney Cue to have committed. After months of investigating, I was now convinced that Sidney Cue was in fact Sidney Cugalier. It's pronounced Cugalier, explaining why he'd been known as Sidney Cue. Until then, I'd never heard of a Cugalier, never mind met one. It was a great name, especially for a journalist trying to track one down. With only a handful of Cugaliers in the whole country, I was hoping most of those I could find would have known Sidney. I went to see one relative, but he'd lost contact with Sidney's branch of the family. Then I got the address of a man who I believed had been close to Cugalier. When I knocked on the door of his bungalow, a woman answered. I explained who I was and said I'd come about Sidney Cugalier. She called into the house, and back came the reply.
Turn the fuck off. I don't want nothing to do with it.
Not quite the response I was hoping for. But it was encouraging in that he hadn't asked me why I wanted to know. He knew why I wanted to know. I was now convinced I was just meters from somebody who knew Sidney Cue and the story of the theft of the World Cup. I left my card with little hope that he'd call me back and parked around the corner to call my news editor. As I began breaking the bad news to my boss, the man pulled up next to me.
Oi, I know why you're here. I can't talk now, but I'll give you a ring to meet up.
Coming up in our final episode.
My dad was looking around, a way of getting in and out without being seen.
And then it come on the telly. You effing bastard, you've nicked that. What have you done this time? Get it out.
Stealing Victory is an original Audi production. If you've enjoyed listening, then please do like us on your podcast app. Leave a review and subscribe. Our hashtag is Stealing Victory, all one word. More information can be found at audi.co/stealingvictory. Stealing Victory is written and hosted by me, Tom Pettifor, with thanks to everyone at the Daily Mirror for their support during the investigation. Sound design is by Norman Goodman. Theme music by Nick Reynolds and Edward Rose. Title music by Guy Farley. Executive editor is Owen Bennett-Jones. Editor-in-chief, Andrew Sampson. And series producer is Zach Brophy.